as anything that I'm about. It is a really a discussion around the structure of consciousness from the ego into the now with the higher self through space and time into infinity and eternity and, you know, pure consciousness. And then the various spiritual tools we can use so that we can witness those different windows on consciousness, if you like.
Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness. And that is why I'm talking today to Carlton Brown, who's, where are you, held up somewhere in Guatemala, in the hills of Guatemala, studying consciousness, studying the deeper ramifications of consciousness and his amazing discoveries about that. Welcome, Carlton. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Alan, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
You were saying you've made some amazing discoveries about the nature of consciousness. Well, talk about your books and what you've discovered.
Okay, sure. Shall I just give a little bit of a background
yes.
of myself just
yes.
to get some flavor because, you know, otherwise, you know, people won't know where I come from.
Exactly.
But, you know, effectively, I've had a, you know, what I would call a very diverse, interesting and eclectic career. You know, I think there are sort of common threads in there really trying to help. First, I started out as a veterinary surgeon
in New Zealand. Veterinary surgeon, you said?
Yes, a veterinary surgeon. So qualified in New Zealand, worked part of my career there and then in the UK and London. You know, the mid-90s, after I got divorced, I went to London Business School and did a Master of Business Administration. And, you know, really that was the beginning of the second stage in my career. I've had a career in life sciences, being a biotechnology CEO and, you know, founding CEO and innovator of a novel vaccine technology. My company was sold about a year ago. In mid-2012, I stepped down as CEO to really bring forward this passion that I've had all my life in both pyramid archaeology and altered states of consciousness. And, you know, I think, you know, I became an author. That was the, you know, the third part of my career. First published my book in January 2014 and relaunched that or republished that on 9/11 last year. And, you
but
know,
you
now
come from
I'm...
A, wait, let me just summarize a little bit because your background is basically science then. You're a science-minded person, but then... There was this shift, or you always were interested in archaeology, you're saying. But
and in altered states of consciousness.
Even while you were doing science. I see. Okay. Yeah. So go ahead, continue, sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, what I did in stepping down as CEO mid-2012 as I moved to Guatemala here, I live in Lake Atitlan, which is a, you know, it's one of the chakras on the face of the planet. I sit literally in front of four massive volcano peaks on top of a fault line, and the lake is a volcano cauldron. And, you know, I published my book, as I say, January 2014, and relaunched that, you know, 9/11 last year. And,
what's the name of your book?
It's called Discovering Ritual Meditation, and the subtitle is Transcendental Healing and Self-Realization.
Okay.
And effectively, what I've done with this book is to really highlight two major discoveries. You know, the first is that I found, discovered a shared archaeological fingerprint from within the pyramid archaeology and the sun god religions. And, you know, and that fingerprint really tells us the, you know, the information around their sacred ritual processes.
What do you mean by fingerprint, though? I'm not sure what you mean.
Sure, it's just a common shared finding. So, we imagine what I've done is to look at essentially four different sun god religions in ancient Egypt, ancient India, Central and South America before the, the Spanish got here. And, you know, this spans some 5 millennia of human history and, you know, 3 different continents. So, you have to ask the question, how did that common fingerprint, you know, find itself, you know, all over the face of the planet? What that fingerprint is about, you know, is effectively it tells us, the timing of their sacred rituals. It tells us the process elements. And most importantly, it tells us meditation was the core ritual process that they supplemented.
Okay. So... But you're saying there must be a common thread, but could it just be a natural phenomenon of a human's relationship on living on the earth and having the sun as the nurturing life force?
I think those are the ability to. It's funny. I'm just watching your cat in the background there.
Oh, yeah.
I think it could have happened by pure chance. It could have happened because there was some sort of communication or shared origin. It could also have happened through communication through altered states of consciousness, or it could have been transmitted through consciousness over time.
Right.
So, you know, all of those are possible. For me, it doesn't really matter. The fact is, it's there.
It's there, this common thread throughout ancient civilization, man, humans, relationship to the sun and the sun gods.
Okay. So, and the second part of the discovery was, you know, effectively I've become a test pilot to these ritual processes over the last few years, and I've used these to profoundly heal and awaken or self-realize. And, you know, what I've been able to do is to reverse engineer the process, develop the ritual meditation process. There's a variant of that process which I call transcendental self-inquiry, which we would use to have the Buddha experience, if you like. And then I show you how to integrate those into what I call a sort of a mind transformation plan to help you awaken and heal.
You show us how to do it through things that you've developed, a process you've developed. And you can read about that in the book, right?
Absolutely. There's nothing left out that you need to know in order to have these types of experiences. I teach you how to meditate, how to prepare for conducting rituals. You know, I show you where you can get the supplies of magic mushrooms on, for example, and then how to really, you know, undertake ritual meditation on the solstices and equinoxes and prepare for that and, you know, all sorts of things. So, you know, as I say, there's no information you need to know.
So it involves a certain practice at special times of the year, the solstice and the equinoxes, with some magical plants, you're saying, mushrooms?
I mean, at its core, the central element is meditation and sensory science. This is what pyramids and, temples were built for. And then what happens with meditation process where we can readily get to the now is we can supplement that. And what we can then do is take our consciousness or awareness outside of this earthly realm into eternity and infinity, or the dimension of, you know, God. I've just kind of lost my train of thought.
No, you were just talking about the book and like the practice that you were developing in the book and how the book helped.
So what we do is we then conduct that meditation at sacred time, and that means on the winter solstice sunrise, the summer solstice sunset, and the equinoxes, depending on the phase of the moon. And we supplement that meditation with hallucinogens, and ideally we align our bodies with Earth's magnetic axis. You know, those were the common findings I found across the face of the planet, in terms of the information embedded in the deity art, in terms of the temple alignments, and actually observing just, you know, the fact that they meditate in these places of sensory science.
Okay, so what have you discovered then in this practice? What have you uncovered?
Well, I think, you know, for me, it's possible to take the basic meditation process and take ourselves out of this earthly realm. And that, you know, that in itself, whilst those experiences are incredibly profound, are fairly short-lived. And what I came to realize is this needs to be integrated into really, you know, what I would call a spiritual lifestyle. So I, you know, rather than calling it a spiritual lifestyle, I call it the mind transformation plan. And, there is, in terms of the discoveries, there's the, meditation for getting to the now, ritual meditation from taking you out of the now into eternity, the transcendental self-inquiry process where you come to ask, who am I in altered states of consciousness as your higher self? And you answer that question, I am, and you refute the ego image that sits in front of you, and you know you have this mind transformation that takes place. The crown chakra opens up, and you know you become permanently transcended.
Back up for one sec. When you refute the ego process that sits in front of you, I think that's a big part there. Because I mean,
yes, it's huge. It's huge.
Can you talk about
that? I mean, yeah, sure. You know, what I did here was I was introduced to Muji last year by a good friend of mine who really helped me through the process of self-realization. And I would literally watch Muji about 5 or 6 hours before I conducted my summer solstice ritual. And it was in watching him for the first time I went, Eureka, I've got it. I understand what this is about. So what I did was rejig my ceremonial fire, the invocation process, the final preparation before the ritual, and effectively my prayers and intentions became that of self-realization and self-inquiry. And, you know, I did my meditation, you know, on the solstice under the influence of magic mushrooms and a little bit of LSD as well. I find there's a nice potentiation goes on there between the two. And literally, as I dissolved this reality, the question just came up. You know, I was a Buddha-like entity, you know, in eternity. And I asked, who am I? And it just spontaneously came up because it's almost like I forewarned consciousness I was coming. And that question arose. I answered the question, I am. And I am was my mantra. I was using the mantra very deliberately to answer that question so that I didn't have to think about the answer. And as soon as that happened, there was a sort of a fictional, if you like, apparition in front of me that I somehow felt was me. I just felt connected with it. And I answered the question, I am, not as an answer, but I just from the absolute core. I am my higher self, and that is not I. And when I did that, my awareness effectively retracted into unity consciousness, and I became the, you know, infinity and eternity and unconditional love. My heart chakra opens up. It then instructs me to put my head back. And so I'm in my meditating chair like a pharaoh. I've got my head back like that, my mouth opened up, and my crown chakra opened. So I visually saw this multicolored chakra, wow. Lotus flower, and I was the all-seeing eye. And, you know, this absolute awareness of I am, just hit me like nothing. And it then told me, you know, this is the most profound experience a human can ever have. And it's the reason you've been born again and again and again until you have this experience. And for some, you know, when I came out of that, you know, particular trip, there was so much information that I had never consumed before that just became instinctive. It was dumped into my
head. Even though you came down from the mushrooms and the LSD, that something stayed, because a lot of times when people do those substances, they have these great, you know, non-egoic experiences, but, you know, after the trip's over, they're back to them, their old selves, and you're saying that didn't happen to you.
Exactly, and it didn't happen to me because of the self-inquiry, self-realization process. In order for that process to go on, the brain effectively is remapped. And if you can imagine what the ego does as a young kid when we're about 3 years of age, it effectively is a counterfeit, imposterous form of artificial consciousness, and it takes over, you know, our window on consciousness as the higher self. And it remaps the brain in order to sustain that and keep us in fictional time. And the process of self-realization effectively brings you back to the now. It remaps the brain. My other chakras had opened up previous to that, you know, so I'd had a number of other experiences with all of my chakras and kundalini activation happen. So this was a sort of a build-up in the process, if you like, over about 15 months. And then the final chakra to open was the crown chakra. And what that means now, particularly as I'm in this very, very special location in Lake Atitlan, is my head buzzes 24/7.
So you don't need to do these rituals again. You just you do them every solstice and equinox. Because it seems like now that you're open, and what would be the reason to continue doing it? Yeah,
sure. I think the important thing is what this does is it places you in the now as your default status. In other words, your mind is quiet. It's just so peaceful and serene. And yes, you can be triggered, and yes, you can have emotions, and yes, you can still escape into fictional time, but it's not your default. Right. Whereas most human beings are in fictional time, and if we're lucky through meditation, we can silence the mind and get to the now. But as soon as we, you know, how do we call it, open our eyes, we come back to fictional time. So it really changes that around for you. I got to say, you know, I don't need hallucinogens really anymore. I can be in the now. And I have not transcended since, whereas before that experience, I was transcending 2 to 3 times out of 4 times. But
what do you mean by transcending? Having that non-ego experience? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Outside of, you know, in eternity, infinity, and, you know, the dimension of unconditional love.
Mm. But that is where you're living, in a way. I mean, that's where you are.
Well, it's you know, this is the thing. I'm sitting here, and you know, how do we call it? Relearning what's going on. You have these experiences, and you suddenly wake up and realize this is a new beginning. It's not the end. And so, you know, the thing that I'm finding is there's a huge amount of misinformation about what we're taught or supposed to experience, and you know, how the ego is supposed to die and disappear afterwards. And you know, that's not the case. We've been given an opportunity where getting control of our mind is made much more easy by being in the now. We can still be triggered.
Well, then let's talk about what we've missed, what we've been misled, what we've been conditioned to think about certain things when other things were really going on. We've been brainwashed by our culture. I mean, culture is a brainwashing. If you read Joseph Chilton Pierce, you ever read his books, The Crack in the Cosmic Egg? He was the first that I found who discovered that, and then his other books. But he was saying what you've done is that you've cracked the egg of culture and you've discovered the true self through whatever means, and now you're aware of who we really are. You're aware of the true nature of the human being. So tell me what you've discovered about what we've really missed about the nature of reality and consciousness.
Well, I think first off is, you know, we're born as the higher self, and something comes along called the ego that hijacks, if you like, our window on consciousness, and, you know, that's the human condition. So, you know, the first thing is most people don't understand. You know, so that's a big thing. The second is if we look at the birth of these ancient world religions, and you know, even the modern religions we have today, you know, you realize the priesthoods were very, very powerful people. And their source of power, you know, they developed dependent relationships both with the masses and the elite and leaders. They held the ritual processes in secret, and they were very, very zealously guarded over time. So the masses have never really had this knowledge and information about consciousness and how to access, you know, real consciousness versus, you know, our ego reality. So, you know, we've effectively been controlled. They use this to control society. And then, you know, the modern world has come along and it's got even more complicated because we have, you know, government, we have, consumerism, we have all of these, the media influencing us and telling us how to live our lives. So we're lost. We're completely lost. But I do think there are people awakening and people are finding this stuff out. And I think that awakening process to me seems to be gathering pace.
So what have you discovered? I know we're lost, but what can you tell us about what you've discovered? What have you actually seen about the nature of reality and consciousness, you know, that was fresh and new?
Well, we need to establish practice in this life for moving the window of consciousness from ego consciousness and fictional time and getting to the now. The now for us is the most important thing. Even after we've done all of these rituals, the thing we have to do is live in the now and transform our minds. So, you know, that for me, living in the now, transforming our minds and, you know, how do we call it? Letting this flourish in our lives, letting this experience flourish in our lives is the key thing, you know, we have to do.
Well, would you say you're more alive now than you've ever been?
Yeah, you know, what is that? What's going on here is, you know, there is love in me again. You know, I didn't have a family. I came from an abusive childhood, so I really needed to heal. And I basically had an older brother all of my life since I left home, but I lost my mom and, you know, my sister and my younger brother just to, you know, the mind stuff that goes on once your family's fractured from this type of abuse. So, God, you're going to have to help me again, Alan.
No, it's just like what you found and discovered about being alive and human. That's key.
So things like loving kindness, compassion, acceptance, forgiveness. I could never forgive people. And now I can. And, you know, equanimity, so that balance of, you know, not liking or disliking something, but trying to treat things and people in the same manner. And just, you know, there's incredible inner peace and joy. But that can all be disturbed if I, I allow my ego consciousness to pull me out of it.
So let's talk about the ancient cultures and how you think they lived. If you just rediscovered what they already knew and had found, What was their lives like? What was the nature of their culture and their practices and their being? Yeah.
Sure. Well, the amount of literature, objective scientific literature available on this talking my kind of story is very, very scant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm a scientist and I believe in data. And then I think it's in the organization of that data that you can, distill it down to its essence. And what I found is I looked at some 450 pyramids and sun god temples from these four different cultures. And I found that 80% of the pyramids and temples were aligned with the equinox sunrise and sunsets, and the winter solstice sunrise and sunset. So 50% equinox, the other third, to the solstices. And when you stop and you look at these structures, they were the domains of the priesthood. So I knew this was their home. This is where they got up to no good, and they left as a fingerprint. But that fingerprint is, It's spread all over the face of the planet, because all of these deity artifacts and things like that are in museums and, whatnot all around the world. The other thing that I found was, in addition to the alignments and therefore their need to tell sacred time, because that was critical to the ritual process, was they used their deity art and icons to embed symbolic information. So the thing that I found, that there was a triad of information. You always see the sun god and the sun goddess. They're in combination with sacred time symbolism. So this was the V47 degree angles that symbolize the solstices, and the serpent as the equinox. And you see them in conjunction with entheogens. So the sun god religions, the pink lotus, the white water lily, the blue water lily, magic mushrooms, and various other chemicals, and the other is, of course, the meditation in sensory silence. So what I deduced from that was they were using art to embed information, much like we use computers and books and things today. And they understood their cosmology, their mythologies, and it was really that art allowed them a discussional opportunity to share the information embedded in that. So I decoded that and realized, this is what they were doing in terms of their rituals. So, effectively what they were doing was, on the solstices, on the equinoxes, the elite and the elite priests would find themselves in situations of sensory silence, and they would conduct these rituals, meditation under the influence of, the hallucinogens. And in some cases, aligning their body with magnetic axis.
But the structure of the pyramid, that's interesting what you said. I think 47, I think it's 51 at the Great Pyramid, the angles. What do pyramids actually do to consciousness?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. A really, really good question. I don't think we know. And I think, there's a lot of speculation, but I've not really seen any hard data to convince me. But I think, first off, but, places like Giza are exceptions, Teotihuacan are exceptions, but I think by and large these pyramids, what they share in common is they were priesthood abodes. They provided places of sensory silence, either these were chambers inside, tunnels under the ground, or temples within the sanctums.
Right. So, go ahead. No, go ahead, because I think you're... No, I think it's interesting that they've become in pyramids all over the planet like that in all these great sun religions.
Yeah. And there are people talking about the special physics, whether they're toroidal fields they're concentrating electrostatic voltage on them, and that somehow is interacting with the biology of, the body. I don't really know, but I'm actually in the process myself of building a small pyramid. And, you're right, I'm going to, it's going to be about 1.75 meters tall. It's going to adhere to the 51.85 degrees that Giza is. Yeah. I'm going to electrify that so I can create small oscillating magnetic fields, and I'm going to have a look and start my experimentation to see if I can improve the process.
Were you directed to build the pyramid? Did you feel guided?
No, just I'm a continual experimenter.
Uh-huh.
That's all I do with my life is, I want to discover knowledge.
Well, if you're okay, then let's talk about another angle here, because you are trained in biology, you're a scientist. What do you feel the rituals and maybe the hallucinogens do to the pineal pituitary system to open the crown to pure consciousness?
Yeah, look, I don't really know. To be honest, I never found any science That, you know, these discussions happen and they're non-scientific, and, you know, that knowledge comes to people through these types of experiences. So I know that people talk about the pineal gland as the source of the DMT or dimethyltryptamine that is released when we die. Now, how meditation and rituals, you know, facilitate that, I don't know. I have a kind of a feeling that, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the brain, and, you know, the frontal brain, or what we would call the third eye, or what I call the third eye, where the crown chakra is, you know, that is the all-important regulator and initiator of the meditation process. And once you activate that, you know, the, how do we call it, the physiology of the brain changes. And, you know, there's a, you know, we know there's a, you know, an upscaling of dopamine production. We know there's a upscaling of 5-hydroxytryptamine 2A, and that works on the, you know, the serotonin receptors in the, you know, in the frontal brain. So whether that is then, if you like, amplifying or causing the release of DMT, I don't know. Now, you know, I've had a near-death experience, so I know what it's like when the pineal gland, you know, I drowned a few years ago.
Oh, I didn't know
that. And I, yeah, 3 years ago. I mean, this was really the beginning of my my journey to healing. I drowned, and, you know, I realized I was let go, and I'd had this out-of-body experience and near-death experience, and I realized I needed to start this journey of healing and, you know, awakening. So, yeah, I mean, and I've taken DMT myself, but it's, to be honest, it's not something I like. It scares the hell out of me.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting, though, because the chemicals affecting our brains and perceptions and consciousness somehow seem to be released, or is consciousness controlling those chemical releases and creating the experiences that we've had? So what are you going to say?
I think, you know, how do we call it, you know, when you have these experiences, you realize your physical journey in life is an epiphenomena of your spiritual journey, and consciousness is imbues it, you know, it drives the entire function of the human experience, you know, our biochemistry. It gives us our awareness. It controls everything that's going on. And, you know, we get this special little vesicle called Earth, you know, to live this out.
Right. Well, it's exciting, though. It's great. Because I know when I had an ecstasy for the first time, MMDA, I felt as if my pituitary or third eye opened, and I had psychic visions. I had perceptions of this woman near me, and I could tell what her history was. I could tell I had this awareness, psychic awareness, or what Castaneda calls seeing. Have you read the Castaneda books?
I've a long time ago, yes.
Oh, you might enjoy them now, because he takes the experiences that you're talking about to a science, almost the science of the Toltecs. They had those, and they were able, Castaneda says, to eventually make the definitive journey by turning their physical body into light.
Yes. Yeah. Which, and I, you know, they did that using rituals. I'm pretty convinced of that, because the symbolism with the Toltecs and the Totonacs and, you know, all of these different Central America, it's the same.
So you think they were pretty enlightened people then, you're saying?
Totally. Far more than we are today.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. Every one of the, you know, now whether that means the masses, I don't know. I'm not convinced on that. I think this was an elite, how do we call it, awareness, because the elite were, you know, part of this inner circle that used these rituals.
Well, you could say it's about elite now. I mean, look at the masses now. They don't care about any of the stuff we're talking about. And so it's a different maybe form of elite, but it's you know, it's a class of people.
I think so. Those with the resources, the money, the positions, and, you know, in work to influence things. So, you know, we live in a world where everyone's out for themselves, and you know, we really have no sort of sense of connection to each other or connection to the planet. And I think, you know, for me, the really important consequence of doing rituals is you reestablish this connection again, and you go, oh my God, look at what we're doing. And, you know, for me, I've just completely redirected my life, and I'm going to spend the rest of my life helping other people awake, because the world needs that.
And you'll help them awake through this ritual outline that you've done there.
Indeed. So, you know, what I'm starting to do is really prepare the groundwork so that I can start coaching people and also conduct rituals as well. So, you know, my ideal would be to get this process into the hands of many, many other people who in turn can also teach this process to people.
Oh, I see. So you do a group thing down there, maybe in Guatemala or something.
I'm looking to do that this year. There's a few things I need to do before that can happen, but, you know, that is the intention, absolutely.
Oh, I see. Because, you know, at least in the Castaneda books, again, he said there was more power doing these things in a group where everyone held a certain position, a certain energetic position of consciousness that amplified the individual. Do you think that's true? Something in a group?
You know, I don't like the idea. No. And the reason I don't is, you know, we came into this world alone and we're going to go out alone. So let's first get in touch with who we are first and foremost.
Okay.
I think one of the keys for me is that in sensory silence. So in other words, completely away from everyone else.
Right.
That makes the release of ego consciousness much easier.
I get it. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. And I think as well, you know, I did a ritual, a group ritual last year. It was a joke. It was an absolute farce.
Why is that?
I just didn't think the process was a very good process. But a poor lady, you know, she was obviously schizophrenic and she had a real crisis between her two personalities. They both wanted to kill each other. And that completely screwed up the ritual for everyone else.
There was too much ego. They didn't do enough work on their own ego development. So there needs to be some work done before you can undertake any of this sort of process. If you just go into a cold, you might end up in that kind of way, it seems like.
I think you have to be incredibly careful, and if you've never done hallucinogens or psychedelics before, I'm a fan of a very slow and phased gradual introduction to psychedelics. I would not be going for the full Monty experience first out.
Right.
I think the nice thing about low doses, you know, you establish a relationship with them, you feel how they work, and they bring up all of that surface material, the low-hanging fruit that you get to look at yourself. And I think, you know, when you read the academic literature, they say the first experiences, they tend to be, you know, a little more variable. But once you've had those first experiences, the experiences tend to be positive thereafter.
I see. I've had positive experience. I haven't done that much, but they've been very... I think it's because I've always had a relationship to my own consciousness that these things have given me a window for even higher and clearer perceptions. So,
yeah.
But it's nothing I want to do too much of.
No, and I don't either. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, you don't need hallucinogens to get to the now. And some people are incredibly lucky and gifted. They can access these higher states of consciousness without hallucinogens. And in some ways, you know, I'm looking at this, you know, process more like a little bit like WD-40. You know, you can use it to get rid of the rust off the nut and the bolt. So that you can slide through the different windows on consciousness. And I think once you've done that, I mean, I used hallucinogens and low dose to get to the now before I self-realized. Now I don't need that. It's there instantly.
Well, it seems like the rust is the ego's mind, you know. That's what's in the way, because this me, self-identification. And something like these substances probably remove that or... And that's also what people who aren't experienced also maybe freak out about, is that suddenly there's no sense of ego for them to even buffer against the non-egoic world or the true world, right?
I think you bring up an incredibly important point. And just to come back to, you know, the death process, you know, if we consider, you know, the gift of life. You know, the enlightened people say we should practice the process of death before we die. In other words, we have these kind of experiences because, you know, you can be religious and spiritual, but if you've not had these experiences and your lights go out and your awareness detaches from your body, you know, you're going to freak.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the process of rituals just allows us to become familiar with and comfortable with the fact that our ego, our consciousness is not, how do we call it? We are not, you know, our ego consciousness. We are not our body. We're not all those things, you know, our feelings, our thoughts, our emotions, but actually we're just ever-present awareness and, you know, in the now and in eternity. And, you know, I think it's really important that we have those experiences so we become familiar with it. Otherwise, we are going to freak when we die. And you know, they, you know, if you I suppose if you look through the, you know, the Buddhist concept of karmic rebirth, that after-death process is incredibly important, and we can shape that through our in-life experience.
Well, let's talk about that other aspect that you bring up, is the idea of the equinoxes and the solstice. Have you tried doing this kind of thing without at other times of year and not had a similar effect? Yeah. So talk about that in a way, and why those alignments are so important to actually our neurochemistry.
I think first off, you know, just to let people know, I have never transcended with meditation alone. I have never transcended with magic mushrooms alone, but when I put the two together, I have about a 50% hit rate. Mm-hmm.
Transcendence, so, you've lost the ego ability,
So can you just jog me there again?
I'm just curious about the solstice and why that has a certain magic to
it. And the simple answer is they were supplementing the meditation process. And the thing that the solstices and equinoxes share in common, you know, around the equinoxes, Earth's magnetic activity peaks.
Oh, I see.
And that, and around the solstices, the Schumann resonances peak, particularly the first mode or the frequency, which is approximately 8 hertz. And what happens when we meditate is we power up our alpha brainwaves. And those alpha brainwaves have an 8 hertz frequency. So what we're doing with the equinoxes and the solstices is we are using those favorable environmental conditions to supplement the voltage of the alpha brainwaves coming powering out of the frontal brain. And the way the brain works, or our states of consciousness work, is that we have to reach critical thresholds in these, you know, critical parameters. So voltages need to reach a certain threshold, as well as the dopamine and the 5-HT2A serotonin. And so that's all we're doing by meditating at sacred time or conducting these rituals at this time of the year, is supplementing that which we naturally produce through meditation.
Have you ever tried it during an eclipse, I wonder? Anything?
No, but I've heard some incredibly interesting stories about that. And this is exactly the same thing. You get this accelerated on-off, you know, raising of the Schumann resonances. Those are the things that I've found. And I've heard of people who can spontaneously transcend at those times.
But there's also a kind of, I think, negative energy that happens during the eclipse. Some people feel a need to cover their heads during a lunar eclipse, you know, anyway. And because of kind of the darker... not quite negative, but undercurrents of the dark moon, you know? That's just actually something I've read and I also experienced. So, you know, it's just we're very connected to the external. I mean, consciousness, we can talk about it, is connected to our, you know, planetary galactic environment.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think that's what the Mayans were after. You're in Mayan country, right? And their whole 2012 alignment, I think, was part of a big planetary awakening that they somehow knew about. What can you say about that?
No, they understood things, you know, to an incredible level. And I think, you know, a lot of those, whilst they were also good observers and good scientists, I think they also probably got a lot of information from access and altered states of consciousness. I think the thing with the Maya and the Mayan calendar is the Maya were very big into saying that if you really wish to understand the cycles of the future, you must, or what's going to happen in the future, is you must understand the cycles of, you know, the past. And I think, you know, these guys understood there had been catastrophic episodes in human history, and that those particular episodes were dependent upon, you know, various alignments within the solar system and within the galaxy. So, they understood the science of altered states of consciousness. So for me, you know, the Maya, it was about altered states of consciousness, but I also think they understood about the future for humanity. And it was
It was about what, you say?
Well, ultimately, I'm in the process now of researching my next book called Ice Age Earth.
And Ice the Age Earth. Oh, be, yeah, we'll talk Ice Age Earth. Okay, yeah, let's talk about
Ice
that.
Age Earth. And the subtitle is Why 2.1K, or the Culling of Humankind. And it was, how do we call it? It was just having that idea that if you want to understand the future, you've got to understand cycles of the past. The Maya made me go, oh my God, I need to look at climate change. And so, you know, I've been on a journey of digging into the data. I'm not really listening to, you know, what's going on in the media. I just deal in data and I'll analyze the data and develop my own story. But the bottom line is we're overdue an ice age. And, you know, these ice ages happen in a cyclical manner. And we're right, you know, we've gone past the peak of the temperature curve.
We're actually about 0.6. Are we gone past it because of the global warming of man-made? No.
No. It happened 2,100 years ago.
A mini ice the age.
No, the peak of our, so, you know, when we come out of an ice age, so when the Earth was covered in ice and the temperature of the planet was at a very low point. And then we've spent 16,500 years coming out of the ice age, you know, in some oscillations up and down, and we're right at the very top of the curve. And, you know, if you can just imagine these curves go up and down like that over time.
Right.
And so, you know, when I do that sort of quantitative analysis of those, you know, the current temperature peak where we are, we're late compared to every single previous peak in the last 3 million years except one.
Well, there was just a program, you know, on 60 Minutes just did something about that by looking at the soil samples at the North Pole or near the North Pole, the sediment, ocean sediment. They saw these cycles of ice age, warming and cold times. So what are you saying then? Yes.
Well, we're not being told this. And therefore, you know, either I'm completely wrong or, you know, science is really dumb or we're being lied to. We're not being told the truth.
Well, what can we do?
And so
yeah, go ahead. So we're, yeah.
So you know, when you look at the data, it's you know, you don't need to be a climate scientist to just see what's going on. And, you know, so I'm of the view, you know, my business background, I went to London Business School and got a, you know, very good, how do we call it, insight into strategy. And so I'm of the view, you know, we've got to build a big surfboard so we can ride this wave into the ice age, and we need to be developing an ice age economy. We need to probably re-engineer the entire global financial system and develop new industries to help us deal and manage the challenges that we're going to face.
What kind of things?
Well, we're going to need new forms of energy. You know, we've got to remove the need. Need for hydrocarbons because, you know, number one, they're problematic for the environment. Number two, they're problematic for geopolitics and, you know, what's going to happen in the future as the planet chills down. We're all going to be racing for oil and gas. So we need to develop new energy systems, you know, and I think what we're doing at the moment, you know, around, you know, renewable energies is interesting, but we've somehow really got to get to, you know, this zero point energy or creating energy greater than, you know, one, you know, for the unit of, you know, energy input. So that's one thing we're going to need to do. Number two, I think we're going to need to develop new food production capabilities that are independent of the sun, because, you know, one of the things that happens and we're experiencing now, you know, since 1950, we've seen a 400% increase in major earthquakes and a 50% increase in major volcanic activity. So we've only got to have one super volcano explosion and, you know, this can wipe out a hemisphere, you know, in terms of the sun reaching the ground. And then, you know, I think, you know, possibly filtration systems, both, you know, for air and water, because, you know, if these volcanic gases are spewing into the atmosphere, you know, these could be problematic for people. And, you know, I think at the heart of this, I'm an innovator. I like the idea of innovation as a means of solving problems. And, you know, I think once you inform people of what's going on, I think, you know, people will naturally find these solutions or the barriers to change will, you know, will come down. But the key thing at the moment is we've spent 15 or so years, you know, behind Al Gore listening to global warming. And, you know, for the last sort of 15 years or so until the last 18 months, you know, the temperatures have actually been going down. And so, you know, what this discussion of global warming or climate change has done is create a very thin veiling curtain And what lies beyond that is a cliff edge into an
answer.
But
they just said 2015 was the warmest year on record.
I mean, you have to look at the data. Yeah. And actually, it's not the warmer, you know, depending on whose record you look at. But, you know, if you go to the International Panel on Climate Change and look at their forecasts, they're using a seam of data only from 1880. And they miss the entire cyclicality of the data sets that are available in, say, 3 million years of climate data. Mm. So, you know, as just as a basic science error, you know, you see that and you go, well, why are they doing that?
So what does it look like? I mean, does it look like a sudden onset of cold? I mean, how do you see it, and when do you see this happening?
Sure. Look, you know, the declines, I think, are gradual. I mean, it takes us 10,000 years to plunge into the depths of cold. But what we don't know really is, are there, you know, the what they call the resolution of the data that I'm looking at is in 100-year increments. So in each of those, you know, data points, we don't know what's going on within those 100 years. So there certainly is evidence in the, you know, the climate science of abrupt climate change. And I think, you know, we don't know, but possibly once you've, how we call it, once you've turned, you know, that turning point might be heralded by some sort of abrupt climate change.
That's just a natural part of the Earth's cycle.
What? Yeah, you know, permafrosts, for example.
Is that brought on by some magnetic field cycle? What do you think brings on the change in this?
I mean, sure. Yeah, no, look, it's a good question, and you know, for me, this is, how do we call it? It's still a cake, and I've only just put it in the oven, so you know, I can't answer all.
No,
all
but
of,
it's
all
just a
questions.
Guess. I mean, you're just creating theories, and yeah.
What happens is, if you look at the last 3 million years of data, pretty well much in the last million years, we've been operating under 100,000 year cycles.
Okay.
So these are what we call the Milankovitch cycles, and these relate to Earth's elliptical orbit around the sun. Prior to that, we seem to be controlled by what they call axial obliquity, the angle, you know, that the Earth's tilted at 23.4 degrees currently, but it oscillates through 1.5 degrees every 41,000 years. So, you know, we have that embedded in the, you know, if you like, the periodicity of the data. 100,000 year cycles, they relate to Earth's orbit. And, you know, there's a lot of other data as well around cosmic radiation inflow into the planet because of solar activity is diminished. And the worry for me right now is we're coming up to a grand solar minimum at 2033 to 2050.
Wait, when you say solar minimum, you mean sunspot cycle?
Yeah. So rather than just the normal 11-year cycle, this is a much longer-term cycle that drags the sun sunspot activity into very, very low, very quiet levels.
And when the sunspot level is low, what happens to – how does that affect weather on Earth?
Okay, I don't know how that affects the weather on Earth. I can tell you what it does is it reduces the magnetic field strength around the solar system and also Earth, and that allows in cosmic radiation. The cosmic radiation drives cloud formation, and that reflects back the sunlight and the planet cools.
Because they say cosmic radiation is the engines of evolution, at least that's my theory. Without cosmic radiation, there's not the abrupt... transformation within the DNA, so cosmic radiation can be a positive thing.
There might be an angle on your interpretation there, that I'm a great believer that climate change and, you know, other cataclysms are the key driver of human evolution.
Yeah.
And species evolution. You know, you've only got to have a look at the biology to see the upsurge in new species that are formed after, you know, these catastrophic events.
Equilibrium, I think, is the Darwinian term for the abrupt acceleration within the fossil record from one species to the next.
I think if humans don't get their act together, I think Mother Earth and consciousness are going to roll the dice again, and maybe some new species or subspecies of humans will emerge that have a greater potential for consciousness evolution.
What was happening to you when you. Well, and us and everyone in the consciousness field, maybe, I'm not saying we're special, but we're maybe evolving as a new species that recognizes the awareness of awareness, right? Like Muji says, or something like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting, the biology of how the ego arises. And, you know, when you stop to realize or you stop to look at, you know, the ego is both a good thing and a bad thing. It gets us into trouble, and ultimately getting us into trouble through life brings us to the point where we realize we need to heal and awaken. So, you know, I think we've yet to, play out fully our potential, you know, of ego consciousness and resolving that paradox and, you know, self-realizing on a grand scale. And my experiences in altered states, I witnessed the birth of the universe out of the metacosmic void on the winter solstice 2014.
Oh, talk and, about know, that, because that, that's not something you just want to, like, glance over. Talk about that witnessing.
I mean, literally 5 days beforehand, I just split up with my girlfriend and I was not in a great spot, but I realized I needed to start the healing journey. And so that was the intention of the process. And, you know, I was living in Antigua at the time, sitting right in front of a big volcano, and I did this ritual. And I was effectively dissolved this reality and was a Buddha entity. Every time I do this, I'm a Buddha entity. And you know, that was incredibly healing. And then, you know, You know, my heart chakra's opened up. I'm just filled with, you know, this bliss, love, consciousness. And then that dissolved, and I was effectively the universe before it was born. I was the metacosmic void. I was infinity, eternity, you know, unconditional love. And I was the central explosion of the universe, imploding inwards and outwards in every direction conceivable. And I witnessed the universe in its entirety and its birth. And, you know, the past galaxies and star systems, I felt the surge in consciousness of species that had awakened. You know, just the magnification of the love and consciousness that you feel when you witness that is phenomenal. And it said to me, you know, this is what it's like when a species awakens. And this is, you know, what it's like when they're not, much like humanity is right now. And this is the, this is the word I'm looking for is this is the destiny of the human species. And this is the reason you have found these ancient ritual processes. It's now time for the human species to have these rituals back.
You got that message clear.
I got that message imprinted into my consciousness. And, you know, I now say God is my boss. You know, this is my job.
Uh-huh. I get it. Now, I get your passion now. Thank you for sharing that. So how did the rituals, the solar ritual, fit in with the work with the Ice Age then? Or this, I think they're connected because it's about waking up. Yeah, talk about that.
It is. So, you know, I think what's happened is we've had 16,500 years coming out of the oven. Sorry, coming out of the freezer.
Yeah.
And these are the windows that this, you know, we had probably, 10,000 humans on the face of the planet at the end of the last ice age, and we've plethorated that to over 7 billion now. And we were given a window of opportunity in what are, you know, effectively very good times, you know, a warming climate. And it is the mission of the species to awaken en masse. And so, you know, there's a process of, you know, we've had some, you know, some great examples of mystics in our deep past. They were few and far between, and they underpinned the major religions and things that, you know, that have, you know, that have been around. And this seems to be happening with a greater frequency today. And I think what's happening is for every person who is awakening and having these profound experiences, we are impacting consciousness for everyone. And so, you know, there is a, you know, I think in some ways this facilitation of this process, and we humans are the, you know, the activators of it, because, you know, there are some of us who've been very, very close to, you know, self-realization, and it's just the destiny of this species to awaken en masse, and we ultimately become the benevolent guardians of the planet.
That's happening now. We are awakening in mass.
Yeah. Not en masse. I think the mass awakening is, you know, because you've only got to have a look at this is the worst I've ever seen the world today.
Really? I thought it was getting much better than it's ever been, the world.
Huh?
I thought the world was much better than it's ever been.
No. I'm just looking at what's going on in the Middle East.
Wow.
What's going on with terrorism? What's going on with all of these conflicts? You know, and the fact that we're spending more on armaments today than we ever have, and we're trying to steal the black stuff out of the ground in different people's countries. And, you know, our politicians are, you know, are corrupt and looking out for their own self-interest, and our corporate, you know, organizations, you know, looking out for the interests of shareholders. So, you know, what are we doing? We're depleting, raping and pillaging and, you know, this planet. So I don't think we are, but I think as a, how do we call it, we're in the dimension of duality, and for all of these bad things that are happening or perceived bad things that are happening, I think what's happening is the positive duality is manifesting itself. And I think, you know, what we are, those people who are awakening, you know, we're the beginning of that, you know, that process of balancing the negative. And, you know, if you were, how do we call it, to take Ken Wilber's philosophy of holonic evolution, we tend to oscillate from one extreme to the other. And then there's a kind of a compromise made, and there's a big jump forward. I think, you know, if I was standing back from this, I think we're accelerating in our cultural, societal evolution. And I think there's more and more people really beginning to awaken or have these incredibly profound experiences. And I'm excited by that.
I'm excited by it, too. I think there is something really amazing happening here. I think we're entering new times. And just the other theory that comes to me as you're talking is this idea of a solar minimum having less cosmic interference with the conscious streams. There's something about that. When there's less cosmic rays, there's a clarity of a connection to the source. I mean, this is what I've read. I don't know if there's anything to it. What do you think?
I don't know on that, to be honest. I can't comment. All I can comment is around the solstices and the equinoxes and their impact on the brain and the biology and our ability to access consciousness. But I don't, I mean, it's an interesting idea.
But it is interesting that as we're working up planetarily, this ice age, as you say, is going to come. And there must be a correlation between that, those two things.
If I were putting my finger on it, I think, you know, I look at what I've done, so what? Most people just shrug it off, you know, they say, oh, I'm interested in your book, but they, you know, people don't really want to put in the time to do the things that they need to do to have these experiences. So, you know, in some ways, you know, the idea for this came to me as I was coming out of altered states of consciousness. The question just dumped into my consciousness as I watched a volcano explode in front of me. Wow. And it said to me, are there more earthquakes and volcanic activity today? And what's going on with the climate? And it just, boom, dumped into my mind. So I went away and did the science thing and went to look. And, you know, ultimately that's, you know, that's where I found it. So I've kind of struggled, you know, what's the connection of that to altered? I think if anything, it's around a wake-up call. Humans are never going to do anything until they know they need to. And I think, you know, while we're being lied to, regarding what's happening with the climate, I don't think there's any sense of urgency to do anything. So I think, you know, in some ways, you know, my process is really pulling apart the curtain and saying this is the future that's going to befall humanity. And as we start and squabble and compete for the dwindling, you know, energy resources, we're going to do all sorts of stupid things. So do we want that, or do we wish to take an active step, evolve our consciousness, change, you know, the way we elect political leaders like they used to do in the ancient world, where they made them use these processes so they could become benevolent and, you know, transform their minds instead of thinking of them selfish selves. So, you know, I think we need to just give people the information. We need to let them know where we stand. We need to let them know there's an 85,000-year ice age coming, and that actually these cycles of climate drive evolution. So what do we want to do? Do we want to wake up and do what we're meant to do as a species, or do we want to do what we've been doing for centuries and competing and fighting with each other and killing each other and making a mess? So, you know, I think there's a link there, and ultimately, you know, this is going to drive human evolution if we don't do something about it.
Well, I think that seems like the link. There's a lineup then of what's happening to the Earth and what's happening to humanity, and it's coming down to the wire, and I think, yes, it is time that we wake up. So then what do you recommend for people as we kind of, you know, wrap up the conversation? I mean, unless there's more you want to say, but, you know, what can people do? You know, they're listening to this conversation. What do you suggest?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, please come and visit my website. You know, it's www.ritualmeditation.com. There's a pile of resources there, meditation calendars, teach you how to meditate. I give you tools to and information to help you understand your own biology. But I think, you know, ultimately what we've got to do is to really put down our dogma, our preconceived ideas. If we're working on ourselves spiritually, doing yoga and meditation and things like that, I think, you know, we've got to re-educate ourselves, and we've got to really look to what the ancient world were doing, and we've got to, how do we call it, remove our stigmas regarding psychedelics, because I don't think we really fully understand, and we're full of misinformation, and start using these ritual processes, whether you use ritual meditation, whether you go and visit a shaman in the Amazon, you know, whether there are other techniques. I think you've got to find what fits for you and realize you have a biology, you can tap into that biology, you can supplement it, and you can expose your real consciousness. And, you know, it's the meaning of life. You know, we need to awaken as to who we are. And in order to do that, because we're rusty, we're going to need a little bit of WD-40. And we need to put these notions and ideas that we might have down in our, you know, in our mind, put them down and begin the process of relearning this know-how, knowledge, and practicing it in our lives.
We lost the connection to ritual in our modern culture.
Yeah. But you say that, but, you know, if you think about most of, in fact, most of the religions today, they have their festivals, their religious festivals like Christmas, you know, in and around the solstices and the equinoxes or phase of the moon, the new full moon. So we're not really actually going to change the timings of that, but we might move from just consumerism at Christmas time to actually understanding we have an opportunity to utilize the environment to help us, you know, to have these special experiences.
So, yeah, we haven't really lost it. Somewhere it's in our culture, you're saying. But also these, those are sort of cultural rituals, the individual rituals of connecting to ourselves. Maybe your birthdays are one thing, but our relationship to the cosmos, as an individual evolving kind of tool, because I think what you're giving us are tools, your tools for awakening.
Totally. These are tools, and you know, I said this to you before the call, if we can imagine the structure on consciousness, the ego in fictional time, the higher self in the now, and it, you know, in eternity, and pure consciousness. And that things like meditation, ritual meditation, transcendental self-inquiry are just different tools that allow us to get to the different windows on consciousness. And that's all there is. Mm. And once we do that, we have these awakening experiences.
So the structure of consciousness, talk a little bit about that, as you're saying.
You know, what happened on the summer solstice self-realization experience I had last year was my experience, I felt I was being shown. I felt it was showing, you know, here is the ego, here is the higher self, here is unity awareness of pure consciousness, together with all of those other experiences. And for some reason, this was just left in my consciousness, my mind. Aha, I get it. You know, here we are, you know, the human condition is, you know, out in fictional time in the past. We're living in the past, or we're projecting the future through the past and therefore through our memories. And, you know, there's a kind of a trap there, and we need to get out of that trap. That's where rituals are really good, because we can just anesthetize or readily dissolve the ego, and we get to the now. And we can, you know, we can, with self-realization, we can just, we are just there naturally. But before self-realization, we need meditation to get there, or those special nature.
I guess that's what we're missing in our culture. Yeah, that connection to the self, the our own consciousness. Yeah, what were you going to say?
I've just recently read Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now and New Earth, and you know, for me, I love this guy, and I love, you know, he describes my world to a T. And, you know, so, you know, definitely well worth a read. But, there was a point I was going to say in there.
The real awakening, I think you were getting to, you know, the sense that we are not the ego mind, but there's, anyway, I think you were getting to.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that was it. You know, he talks about what it's like to be in the now. And what I found quite difficult with his book is I don't think he quite understood the structure of consciousness. I think he called it the power of now. But actually, what the power of now is, it's the only place you're ever going to experience your consciousness. So actually, you know, the now is synonymous with the higher self, mm-hmm. and that window on consciousness.
That's a good point. And yes. Yes. Hello?
It's time.
Wait, repeat that. I lost you for a second. No, go ahead. Repeat what you're saying.
So what I have is I've got this sort of vision in my mind that, you know, the ego consciousness in fictional time is, you know, what it is. It's in the past and in the future. The now is disrupted time, you know, because when you meditate and you get to the now, you wonder where did that hour and a half go. So, you know, it disrupts your concept of time. And what it does is it places your, you know, there in the now, you witness your higher self. And when you do rituals, you pull that awareness out through space and time into eternity and infinity. So there's a straddling going on from you yourself as unity and the individuation of the higher self out in eternity. And there's, I call it the space-time portal. It's like a wormhole. I think consciousness straddles a wormhole. And I think, you know, the earthly side of that is in the now. And the now is disrupted time. So it's a bit like the opening to the vortex of, you know, the wormhole through space and time.
So the structure, yeah, no, I get that. The wormhole would be what? The present? The now? Is that the wormhole?
That's the opening. The now is the opening. Mm-hmm. And it's only by going deeper and deeper and deeper into the now and, you know, that awareness, and this is where the rituals come in, that we can part, you know, whatever that is. Because the thing that I notice is when I'm doing this and I'm in these rituals, there's a vortex going on and there's a dissipation process going on. And you move from, you know, complete darkness with eyes closed, and the visuals begin to start, and, you know, and then the next thing, you emerge outside of this reality. And there you are with that feeling of eternity and infinity, depending upon if it's just the higher self or if it's pure consciousness.
So you actually see a vortex, you actually see a portal in front of you.
Yeah.
You see feel it.
I see, well, what I see is the dissipation, I see the helical coil. It unwinding, dissipating.
I see.
Yes.
So is that...
So that, you know, that for me, you know, if you could... Now, I was going to say, you know, if you can imagine that we are one. Now, we say that in words and language and, you know, we use that in our spiritual language, but you will only ever know that when you experience unity, awareness, and pure consciousness. That's when you, you know, you get it. And so, you know, if we are all, you know, connected, we all are consciousness and connected to pure consciousness, you know, then we are all part and parcel and interconnected to, you know, the collective whole. But the point is that, you know, we have, how do we call it? We have this earthly dimension where, you know, we see ourselves as separate. So somehow, you know, and this for me, I don't know, and it's not worth getting sidetracked on, but I love the idea of the interface between physics and metaphysics. You know, what's really going on? And how does this, you know, happen? How does it physically happen, you know, in the universe? I find that an intriguing question.
You say the interface between physics and what was the other?
Metaphysics.
Oh, I see.
You know, the very fabric of consciousness lying behind the physical universe that, you know, basically enables it. For me, consciousness drives every single process in the universe. Mm.
So the structure of consciousness is what then, really, when you say the structure?
You know, it's an amorphous structure. It's not a physical structure. It's a conceptual structure that I'm relaying to you. And, you know, the words that I'm using are the best that I can, but they are, you know, how do we call it, fallible compared to the real experience. But it really is just understanding, you know, we view this life and, you know, the way we currently do. When we get into the now, we realize that experience is fundamentally different from the day-to-day experience. And then when we pull ourselves out of this reality altogether, that's a fundamentally different experience.
Right.
And, you know, that can just be as the higher self, or it can be as unity, awareness, and pure consciousness. So those, for me, are the windows.
And
it's just the meditation and the ritual meditation process that allows you to navigate those. That's all.
Do you think there's something even more than where you went? I mean, you went to unity consciousness, you transcended the ego mind, but could there even be, I don't know, I'm just asking, an even another level beyond that?
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is, and we'll probably only ever know that when we die, you know, as long as we're not reborn. These are all the answers I have. I don't really know.
Well, no, it's valuable because you're an explorer. You've explored. Yeah, yeah. That's what you feel like. And
it's funny. I a little bit of an Indiana Jones, to be honest.
Well, you're living right there in the old temples of the world. And
yeah, yeah. I mean, look, you know, it's incredible. I've done rituals at El Mirador. You know, I walked 50K barefoot through the jungle last year, and my friends rode their motorbikes through the jungle just so that we could go and do a ritual. And, you know, to do a ritual and have that interaction, if you like, you know, I felt a force, a huge force, and I felt that I was amongst ancestors. You know, I felt their presence around me as I did this ritual. And I went to consult them about what should I do with this knowledge and information I have. And, you know, the left into my consciousness was just write the books.
Yeah, no, okay. I was just wondering if you tune into the, and in those states, you tune into beings in other dimensions and other frequencies of being.
This is why I'm building my pyramid right now. I want to go and have contact with aliens. I want to go and talk to them.
You haven't yet.
No, I've felt the presence of awakened species. So I know they're there. I know there is life throughout the universe, all throughout the universe, awakened and unawakened, evolving life. So now I want to take that to the next step. And I know through ritual intention. Stanislav Grof talked about this. Have you come across Stanislav Grof?
Yeah, I did a little interview with Stanislav Grof. He says, you know, consciousness is the nature of being. You know, he was one of the first I talked to about the nature of consciousness. Yes. So.
Yeah, he's one of my heroes and people I really look up to, you know. But, you know, he talks about the possibility of having alien contact in, you know, his book LSD, Doorway to the Numinous. He defines the types of experiences that people can have. And, you know, so I know that they exist. I now wish to make this my ritual intention of going to talk to them. And I kind of want to go to talk to find out, you know, what can we do as a species?
Well, it seems, you know, like actually, just to tell you what I get is that they're actually already talking to you. They're. It's not about little green men or gray men. It's about perceptual downloads from the source itself. You know, that's all any of us are, and that's what you're being downloaded. You know, with these.
It's funny, you know, I started life, you know, I've been into this all my life, probably since my life was impacted by pyramids and anti-gravity at the age of 4. And, you know, through my father and, you know, what he was up to. So, you know, I've been connected with this.
What
and
was
I,
it at that a very your father young, was doing at the age of 4 that you were?
Getting into trouble. My father was a marine engineer, and he was involved in the design and development of turbines for nuclear power stations, hydroelectric dams, and, you know, warships. So he started out in the Navy. And as a byproduct of what he was into was magnetism and electromagnetism. And he had a real interest in anti-gravity, the ancient world. And he was convinced the governments knew about this knowledge. And he was trying to share his insights and designs with, you know, with the British government, and they didn't want to know. They didn't want to listen to them. And so he gave it to the Russians, and he got told off. He basically investigated by MI5, told he would never get another job in the UK, and that's ultimately why we migrated to New Zealand. So that had a huge impact on my life. And, you know, I've always had an inquiring mind. And from about sort of 10 or 12 years of age, I always knew there was an emergent truth between religion, spirituality, the history of the world, UFOs, aliens, conspiracy theory. And, you know, in mythology and cosmology, I knew there was an emergent truth. And I still believe that today. And I followed that all my life.
Well, let's do another program on that, maybe, the consciousness of alien awareness. But, no, thank you. Anything you want to leave this program with? Because
I think, you know, look, there's so much knowledge and information here. And I would just strongly encourage anyone who is curious wants to know more, please, you know, have a look at my website, www.ritualmeditation.com. There's a lot of resources there that you can look at. You can download my book from Amazon and iTunes. You can also make contact with me if you're interested in coaching so that I can help you start that journey and hold your hand. And also just let me know your interest in, you know, healing retreats and your potential interest in an e-learning course.
Your book is called what? Ritual Meditation?
It's called Discovering Ritual Meditation, mm-hmm. and it's, the subtitle is Transcendental Healing and Self-Realization.
And then your email, you said, is?
Well, the website address is www.ritualmeditation.com, and you can, you know, if you want to get hold of me, there's contact forms there to do that.
Well, thanks so much for having this, you know, to share your insights, because I know, in a way, how personal they are. And I appreciate you opening up here with me to share this with the world. So
it's a Alan, I really appreciate the opportunity, and you know, I came across you through a good mutual friend, yeah. You know, Dana Novak. So we just really appreciate that you opened up to that and the possibility. And there's one thing I do want to say, one more. And that is, if we look at the great mystics and we look at the people in more contemporary times who've had these experiences, we must remember every single one that I've researched happened by grace. They were on the spiritual path or not, and they had these experiences. They didn't really know how they happened in the moment, but they happened. They transformed their minds. What I've done in the rediscovery of this know-how and knowledge, this is the first time in the history of humankind this knowledge and information has been put in the public domain with the validation that we've been using this stuff for thousands of years.
Right. Even Eckhart Tolle was graced with him. You're right. So you're saying now we can purposely intend this type of awakening.
Totally. And you need to understand the methods which I fully describe in my book, Discovering Ritual Meditation, if you wish to go through this. Because this is imminently available to everyone. If you were an advanced meditation yoga practitioner, this will happen to you in a very short space of time.
Great. Thank you, Carlton. Thank you. I've been talking to Carlton Brown from the jungles of Guatemala about his ritual meditation experience and awakening humanity. Really, I think that's really what the core of the conversation was. I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Thanks for watching. And you can always find me at newrealities.com. Thank you.